On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For 7 years now, The New Yorker magazine has thrown a fall cultural bash called the New Yorker Festival, a weekend celebration of art, music, film, food, and literature. At On Point, we've made readings from the festival part of our Thanksgiving holiday tradition. Today, you'll hear stories written and read by literary luminaries Donald Antrim, T.C. Boyle, Louise Erdrich, and Laurie Moore. This Thanksgiving Day, On Point, settle in, chop the onions, and enjoy. We start with T.C. Boyle, author of 8 short story collections and 11 novels, including Talk Talk. Here, he reads an excerpt from his short story La Conchita, which is in the book Tooth and Claw, about a delivery driver navigating the California mudslide tragedy of January 2005.
I didn't like driving in the rain. It was just asking for disaster. My fellow drivers, riding their brakes and clinging to the wheel as if it were some kind of voodoo fetish that would protect them against drunks, curves, potholes, errant coyotes, and sheet metal carved into knives, went to pieces the minute the first drop hit the windshield. As you might expect, the accident rate shot up something like 300% every time it rained. And as I say, this wasn't just rain in the ordinary sense. But I had a delivery to make in Santa Barbara, an urgent delivery. And if I couldn't guarantee door-to-door faster than FedEx or Freddy Altamirano, my major competitor, who rode a Pro Street FXR and moved like a spirit raptured to heaven, then I was out of business. Plus, this wasn't just the usual packet of bonds or stock certificates or the blockbuster screenplay passing from writer to director and back again. This was the kind of thing I handled maybe 2 or 3 times a month at most, and it never failed to give me a thrill. In the trunk, anchored firmly between 2 big blocks of styrofoam, was a human liver packed in a bag of ice slurry inside a Bud Light Fun in the Sun cooler. And if that sounds ridiculous, I'm sorry. That's how it's done. Simple fact. 90 minutes earlier, I'd picked it up at LAX because the SB airport was closed due to flooding. And if you want a definition of time sensitive, this was it. The recipient, a 27-year-old mother of 3, was on life support at University Hospital, and I was running late, and there wasn't much I could do about it. At any rate, I was coming up on La Conchita, rounding the big curve at Muscle Shoals and dropping down to 4th to blow past a U-Haul truck. The worst, the very worst, but that's another story. When the hillside gave way, there was a series of sharp cracks I at first took to be lightning hitting the hill, and then a deep, reverberant concussion as if all the air had been knocked out of the day. By this point, I was shifting down, hyper-aware of the chain of brake lights flung up across the road in front of me, and the U-Haul, piloted by a zombie on his way to Goleta or Lompoc with his zombie girlfriend at his side and their little white dog in her lap, bearing down on me from behind. I was able to stop. They weren't. They barely had time to flash their brake lights before skidding past me and hammering the back end of a Mercedes with its panic lights on, lifting the whole shimmering orange and white truck up on 2 wheels before it crashed down on its side. I'll say right up front, I've never been much in an emergency. And when you're behind the wheel as often as I am, you see plenty of emergencies, believe me. I don't know CPR, don't know how to stay calm or counsel anybody else to stay calm either. And I've been lucky because it's never been me, wrapped around the telephone pole or nodding over the windshield, and nobody I know has ever choked at the dinner table or clutched their head or started hemorrhaging from the mouth and ears. I saw the dog lying there in the road like a heap of rags, saw the driver of the moving truck haul himself up out of the driver's side window like a pearl diver coming up for air, saw the rain eclipse him. And the first thing I did, for my own sake and for the sake of whoever else might be tooling up behind me, was pull the car off the road as far up on the shoulder as I could take it without fear of getting stuck. I was just reaching for my cell to dial 911, the road blocked, the day shot, my mind churning, and the donor organ sitting there undelivered and unincorporated and getting staler by the minute, when things got worse, a whole lot worse. I don't know if the average person really has any idea of what a mudslide involves. I certainly didn't. Not before I started driving for a living, anyway. You'd see footage on the 6 o'clock news, telephone poles down, trees knocked askew, a car or two flattened in a garage, staved in. But it didn't seem like much. It wasn't hot lava. It wasn't an earthquake or one of the firestorms that burned through this subdivision or that and incinerated a couple hundred homes every fall. Maybe it was the fault of the term itself, mudslide. It sounded innocuous, almost cozy, as if it might be one of the new attractions at Magic Mountain, or vaguely sexy, like the mud wrestling that was all the rage when I was in high school and too young to get in the door. But that was the thinking of a limited imagination. A mudslide, as I now know, is nothing short of an avalanche. But instead of snow, you've got 400,000 tons of liquefied dirt bristling with rock and tree trunks coming at you with the force of a tsunami. And it moves fast, faster than you'd think. The sound I'd heard, even through the rolled-up windows and the ready voice of the narrator of the book on tape I'd checked out of the library, was the sudden, angry shriek of the bulkhead in back of La Conchita giving way. Steel beams snapped like chicken bones. Railroad ties went airborne. Up ahead of me, beyond the overturned U-Haul, a few of the cars had got through, but now a vanguard of boulders came sluicing across the freeway, followed by a soupy river of mud. A rock the size of a cannonball thumped into the underside of the U-Haul truck, and a fistful of pellets, gravel I guess, sprayed the side of my car, and that was going to mean a new paint job, I knew it, maybe even bodywork. The rain quickened. The mud spread out across the pavement, seething round the tires and underneath the car and beyond, and soon dark tongues of it had pushed across the southbound lanes too. What did I do? I got out of the car, the normal reaction, and immediately my shoes filled with sludge. The mud was no more than a foot or so deep, and here at the far verge of the slide, it was the consistency of pancake batter, but darker. And it smelled of something long buried and dug up again, damp and raw as an open grave. And for a moment there, I flashed on my father's funeral, the squared-off edges of the hole with its fringe of roots, my mother trying to be stoic and my uncle putting an arm round my shoulders as if that could help. Let me say, it wasn't a pleasant smell, and leave it at that. Doors slammed. Somebody was shouting. I turned my head to look up the road, and there was the driver of the U-Haul pulling his wife or girlfriend or whoever she was up out of the cab, even as she reacted to the sight of the dog lying there on a clean stretch of pavement, and the mud, working to its own logic, flowed around it. Behind me were at least 100 cars, bottled up and idling, their lights dully illuminating the scene, windshield wipers clapping in the way of a very tired audience. People were running up the street. A pickup just north of the overturned U-Haul began to float off, sustained on a wave of mud as if it were a dinghy drifting away on the tide. My jacket was soaked through, the hair hanging in my face. The liver wasn't getting any fresher. Suddenly, unaccountably, I found myself at the trunk of the car. I inserted the key and flipped it open, and I don't really know why, just to reassure myself, I guess. The lid of the cooler eased back, and there it was, the liver. Smooth and burnished, more pink than red. And it wasn't like meat, not at all. More like something sculpted out of very soft stone. But it was okay, it was fine, I told myself, and I should just stay calm. I figured we had an hour, more or less, before things began to get critical. It was then that the woman with the dog, she was bent over it in the rain, wailing, and the water dripping from the end of her nose was pink with the blood leaching out of her scalp, looked up and shouted something to me. She might have been asking if I knew anything about dogs, or if she could use my cell to call the vet, or if I had a knife, an oxygen mask, a GPS locator, a blanket. I don't know what she said, actually. She wanted something, but I couldn't hear her over the rattle of all those idling engines, the hiss of the rain, the shouts and curses, and in the next moment, somebody else was there, some stranger, and he was taking care of it. I ducked back into the car just to get out of the rain, mud everywhere, mud on the carpets, the door frame, the console, and punched in the cell number of the assisting physician at the hospital. "There's a problem," I said. His voice came back at me in a thinly amplified yelp. "What do you mean? Where are you?" "I may be 15 miles south at La Conchita. That's what I mean. But I can't get through because there's some kind of slide. It just happened and it's blocking the road totally." For the first time, I looked up at the mountain outside the window and saw the scar there and the trail of displaced earth and the crushed houses. Everything was gray with the rain. "How long before they clear it?" "Actually, could be a while." He was silent, and I tried to picture him. Nobody I knew. An intern, maybe. Glasses, short hair, because it was easier to maintain when your life wasn't your own. Biting his lip and staring out the window into the pall of the rain. "Is there any way I can get to you? I mean, if I jump in the car and..." "Maybe," I said, And I wanted this to work in the worst way because my reputation was on the line here. And that woman needed her liver. She'd been waiting for Christ knew how long, somebody freshly dead in Phoenix, and this was the best match. And I'd walk it there if I could, no doubt about it, walk till my feet turned to stumps. But I had to be honest with him. "Hey, you've got to realize the traffic's already backed up in both directions," I said. And I wasn't calm at all. I mean, nothing's going through. There's an accident just in front of me, and there's mud and rocks all over the road in both directions. Even if you leave now, you're not going to be able to get within 5 miles of here. So you tell me. Tell me what you want me to do. Tell me. Another silence. "All right," he said finally. His voice was pinched. "You know how urgent this is, how crucial. We'll get this done. We will. Just keep your cell on, right? And don't do anything till I get back to you." I must have sat there for 5 minutes at least, just staring out into the rain, the cell clutched in my hand. I was wet through and I'd begun to shiver, so I turned the engine over and got the heater going. The mud was still flowing, I could see that much. And the white dog had disappeared along with the couple from the U-Haul. Apparently they'd found shelter somewhere, in the little gas station cum grocery that was La Conchita's sole commercial establishment, or maybe in one of the cars stalled behind me. There were people out on the pavement, hunched over forms, wading through the mud and shouting at one another, and I thought I heard the distant keening of a siren, police, fire, ambulance, and wondered how they expected to get through. You might find it hard to believe, but I really didn't think much about the danger, though if another section of the hillside were to go, we'd all be buried, no doubt about it. No, I was more concerned with the package in the trunk. Why hadn't they called me back? What were they waiting for? I could have been slogging down the road already, the cooler propped up on one shoulder, and somebody, I thought of an ambulance from the hospital, could have met me a couple miles up the freeway. But no, the ambulances would all be busy with the wreckage in front of me.
That was novelist and short story writer T.C. Boyle reading from La Conchita in his short story collection Tooth and Claw. Laurie Moore is the author of 3 novels, including Who Will Run the Frog Hospital and Anagrams, and 3 short story collections, including Birds of America. Here she is at this year's New Yorker Festival.
It's really an honor to be here, especially since I haven't published anything in the New Yorker for a long time. And one of the reasons I haven't published a lot of work recently is that about 5 years ago I got a divorce. And after I picked myself up off the floor, I started writing a lot of divorce stories. And I didn't finish very many of them, and they all went into a drawer. They all had in common the word bimbo. And they all featured protagonists who couldn't get their wedding rings off. Actually, one of those stories we did publish, yeah. But for tonight, I decided I would read something that I've never read before, and so I pulled one of these old things out of the dark drawer where it will return after this evening, I think. But it's called Paper Losses, and it has the word bimbo in it. Although Kit and Rafe had met in the peace movement, marching, organizing, making no nuke signs, now they wanted to kill each other. They had also become a little pro-nuke. Married for 2 decades of precious, precious life, she and Rafe seemed currently to be partners only in anger and dislike. Their old lusty love mutated to rage. It was both the shame and demise of them that hate, like love, could not live on air. And so in this, their newly successful project together, they were complicitous and synergistic. They were nurturing, homeopathic, and enabling. They spawned and raised their hate together, cardiovascularly, spiritually, organically, in tandem, as a system, as a dance team of bad feeling. They had shoved their hate center stage and shown a spotlight down for it to seize. Do your stuff, baby. Who's the best? Who's the man? Pro-nuke? You are? Really? Kit was asked by friends, to whom she continued to indiscreetly complain. See, there's a split infinitive. That's why you keep these things in a drawer. Well, no, Kit sighed, but in a way, you seem like you need someone to talk to. which hurt Kit's feelings since she'd felt she was talking to them. I'm just concerned about the kids, Kit said. Rafe had changed. His smile was just a careless yawn. Or was his smile just stuck carelessly on? Which was the correct lyric? She did not know. But for sure, he had changed. In Beersboro, they put things neutrally like that. Such changes were couched. No one ever said a man was now completely f***ed up. They said, the guy has changed. Rafe had started to make model rockets in a basement. He'd become a little different. He was something of a character. The brazen might suggest he's gotten into some weird shit. The rockets were tall, plastic, penile-shaped things to which Rafe carefully shellacked authenticating military decals. What had happened to the handsome hippie she had married? He was prickly and remote, empty with fury. A blankness had entered his blue-green eyes. They stayed wide and bright, but non-functional like dime store jewelry. She wondered if this was a nervous breakdown, the genuine article. But it persisted for months, and she began to suspect, instead, a brain tumor. Occasionally, he catcalled and wolf-whistled across his mute alienation. His pantomime of hate momentarily collapsed. Hey, cutie, he would call to her from the stairs after not having looked her in the eye for 2 months. It was like being snowbound with someone's demented uncle. Should marriage be like that? She wasn't sure. She seldom saw Rafe anymore when he got up in the morning and left for his office. And when he came home from work, he would disappear down the basement stairs, nightly in the anxious dusk that was now their only life together. After the kids went to bed, the house would fill up with fumes. When she called down to him about this, he never answered. He seemed to have turned into some sort of space alien. Of course, later, she would understand that all this meant was that he was involved with another woman. But at the time, protecting her own vanity and sanity, she was working with two hypotheses only, brain tumor or space alien. All husbands are space aliens, said her friend Jan. God help me, I had no idea, said Kit. She began spreading peanut butter on a pretzel and eating quickly. Do you fight about it? About what? Asked Kit. About the rockets back to his homeland, said Jan. Kit sighed. Yes, the toxic military crafts business poisoning our living space. Do I fight? Why, I don't fight. I just, well, okay. I ask a few questions from time to time. I ask, what the hell are you doing? I ask, are you trying to asphyxiate your entire family? I ask, did you hear me? And then I ask, did you hear me again? And then I ask, are you deaf? I also ask, what do you think a marriage is? I'm just really curious to know. And also, is this your idea of a well-ventilated place? A simple interview, really. I don't believe in fighting. I believe in giving peace a chance. I also believe in internal bleeding. She paused to shift the phone more comfortably against her face. I'm also interested, Kit said, in those forensically undetectable dissolving plastic bullets. Have you heard of those? No. Well, maybe I'm wrong about those, said Kit. I'm probably wrong. That's where the mysterious car crash may have to come in. In the chrome of the refrigerator, she caught the reflection of her own face, part brunette Shelley Winters, part potato, the finely etched sharps and accidentals beneath her eyes, a musical interlude amidst the bloat. In every movie she had seen with Shelley Winters in it, Shelley Winters was the one who died. Peanut butter was stuck high and dry on Kit's gums. On the counter, a large old watermelon had begun to sag and pull apart in the middle along the curve of seeds like a shark's grin. And she lopped off a wedge, rubbed its cool paint around the inside of her mouth. It had been a year since Rafe had kissed her. She sort of cared and sort of didn't. A woman had to choose her own particular unhappiness carefully. That was the only happiness in life, to choose the best unhappiness. An unwise move, good God, you could squander everything. The summons took her by surprise. It came in the mail addressed to her, and there it was, stapled to divorce papers. She'd been properly served. The bitch had been papered. Like a person, a marriage was unrecognizable in death, even buried in its favorite suit. Atop the papers themselves was a letter from Rafe suggesting their spring wedding anniversary as the final divorce date. Why not complete the symmetry, he wrote, which didn't even sound like him, though its heartless efficiency was suited to this, his new life as a space alien, and in keeping generally with the principles of space alien culture. The papers referred to Kit and Rafe by their legal names, Catherine and Raphael, as if it were the more formal versions of themselves who were divorcing. The birth certificates were divorcing, and not they themselves. Rafe was still living in the house and had not yet told her he'd bought a new one. Honey, she said, trembling, something very interesting came in the mail today. Rage had its medicinal purposes, but she was not wired to sustain it, and when it tumbled away, loneliness engulfed her, grief burning at the center in a cold blue heat. At two different funerals of elderly people she hardly knew, she went in and wept in the back row of the church like a secret lover of the deceased. She felt woozy and ill and never wanted to see Rafe again, or rather Raphael, but they had promised the kids this Caribbean vacation, so what could she do? This, at last, is what all those high school drama classes had been for, acting. She had once played the queen in A Winter's Tale, and once a changeling child in a play called Love Me Right Now, written by one of the more disturbing English teachers in her high school. In both of these, she learned that time was essentially a comic thing. Only constraints upon time forced it to tragedy, or at least to misery. Romeo and Juliet, Tristan and Isolde, if only they'd had more time. Marriage stopped being comic when it was suddenly halted, at which point it became divorce, which time never disturbed, and so the funniness of which was never ending. Still, Rafe mustered up 30 seconds of utterance in order to persuade her not to join them on this vacation. I don't think you should go, he announced. I'm going, she said. We'll be giving the children false hope, he said. Hope is never false, she said, or it's always false. Whatever, it's just hope. Nothing wrong with that. I just don't think you should go, he said. Divorce, she could see, would be like marriage, a power grab. Who would be the dog, and who would be the owner of the dog? What bimbo did he want to give her ticket to? Only later would she find this out. They had not, however, yet signed the papers. There was the matter of her wedding ring, which studded with little junk emeralds, and which she liked a lot and hoped she could continue wearing because it didn't look like a typical wedding ring. He had removed his ring, which did look like a typical wedding ring, a year before, because he said, quote, it bothered him, unquote. She had thought at the time he'd meant it was rubbing. He had often just shed his clothes spontaneously. When they had first met, he was something of a nudist. It was good to date a nudist. Things moved right along. But it was not good trying to stay married to one. Soon she would be going on chaste geriatric dates with other people whose clothes would, like hers, remain glued to her body. What if I can't get my ring off, she said to him now on the plane to La Caribe. She had gained a little weight in her 20 years of marriage, but really not all that much. She had been practically a child bride. Send me the Sawyer's bill, he said. Oh, the sparkle in his eye was gone. What is wrong with you, she said. Of course, she blamed his parents, who had somehow, long ago, accidentally or on purpose, raised him as a space alien, with space alien values, space alien thoughts, and the hollow, shifty character, concocted guilelessness and sociopathic secrets of a space alien. What is wrong with you? He snarled. This was his habit, his space alien habit, of merely repeating what she had just said to him. It had to do, no doubt, with his central nervous system, a silicon-chipped information processor incessantly encountering new linguistic combinations, which it then had to absorb and file. Repetition bought time and assisted the storage process. More than the girls, who were just little, she was worried about Sam, their sensitive fourth grader, who now sat across the airplane aisle, moodily staring out the window at the clouds. Soon, through the machinations of the extremely progressive divorce laws, a boy needs his dad. She would no longer see him every day. He would become a boy who no longer saw his mother every day. And he would scuttle and float a little off and away, like paper carried by wind. With time, he would harden. He would eye her over his glasses in the manner of a maitre d' suspecting riffraff. "And you are who?" But on this, their last trip as an actual family, he did fairly well at not letting on. They all slept in the same room in separate beds and saw other families squalling and squabbling, so that by comparison, theirs, a family about to break apart forever, didn't look so bad. She was not deceived by the sea breeze, and so did not overbake herself in the colonial sun. With the resort managers, she shared her moral outrage at the armed guards who kept the local boys from sneaking past the fence onto this white, white beach. And she rubbed a kind of resin into her brow to freeze it there and downplay the creases, to appear younger for her departing husband, though he never once looked at her. Not that she looked that good. Her suitcase had gotten lost, and she was forced to wear clothes purchased from the gift shop, the words La Caribe emblazoned on every single thing. On the beach, people read books about Rwandan and Yugoslavian genocide. Sam liked only the trampoline and nothing else. There were dolphin rides, but Sam sensed their cruelty. "They speak a language," he said. "We shouldn't ride them." "They look happy," said Kit. Sam looked at her with seriousness from some sweet beyond. "They look happy, so you won't kill them." "You think so?" "If dolphins tasted good," Sam said, "we wouldn't even know about their language." That the intelligence in a thing could undermine your appetite for it, that yumminess obscured the mind of the yummy as well as the mind of the yummer, that deliciousness resulted in decapitation, that you could only understand something if you did not desire it. How did he know these things already? Usually girls realized this first, but not her girls. Her girls, Beth and Dale, were tough, practical, self-indulgent, independent five-year-old twins, a system unto themselves. They had their own secret world of Montessori code words and plastic jewelry and hilarities based largely on the phrase cinnamon M&Ms repeated 6 times fast. They wore sparkly fairy wings wherever they went, even over cardigans, and they carried wands. "I'm a big brother now," Sam had said to everyone, and with uncertain pride, the day the girls were born. And after that, he spoke not another word on the subject. Sometimes, silently, Kit accidentally referred to Beth and Dale as Death and Bale, as they, for instance, buried their several Barbies in sand, then lifted them out again with glee. Someone on a towel, reading of genocide, turned and smiled. In this fine, far compound on the sea, the contradictions of life were grotesque and uninventable. She went to the central office and signed up for a hot stone massage.
Author Lori Moore reading an excerpt from her short story Paper Losses at the New Yorker Festival earlier this fall. Louise Erdrich is a novelist, memoirist, and poet. Her books include The Painted Drum, which came out last year, and the award-winning Love Medicine. Here she reads an excerpt from a story called The Plague of Doves.
In the year 1896, my great-uncle, one of the first Catholic priests of Aboriginal blood, put the call out to his congregation that they should gather at St. Gabriel's, wearing scapulars and holding missals, and from that place they would proceed to walk the fields in a long sweeping row, and with each step loudly pray away the doves. When the birds descended, both Chippewa and White set up great bonfires and tried driving them into nets. The doves ate the wheat seedlings and the rye and started on the corn. They ate the sprouts of new flowers and the buds of apples and the tough leaves of oak trees and even last year's chaff. The doves were plump and delicious smoked, but one could wring the necks of hundreds or thousands and affect no diminishment of their number. The pole and mud houses of the mixed bloods and the bark huts of the blanket Indians were crushed by the weight of birds. They were roasted, burnt, baked up in pies, stewed, salted down in barrels, or clubbed dead with sticks and left to rot. But the dead only fed the living, and each morning, when the people woke, it was to the scraping and beating of wings, the murmurous susurration, the awful cooing babble, and the sight to those who still possessed intact windows of the curious and gentle faces of those creatures. My great uncle had hastily constructed criss-crossed racks of sticks to protect the glass in what, with grand intent, was called the rectory. In a corner of that one-room cabin, his youngest brother, whom he had saved from a life of excessive freedom, slept on a pallet of fir boughs and a mattress stuffed with grass. This boy was to become my mother's father, my musham. Seraph Milk was his given name, and since he lived to be over 100, I actually was present and about 10 years old during the time he told and retold the story of the most momentous day of his life, which began with this attempt to vanquish the plague of doves. Musham was our favorite indoor entertainment, next to the television. But our father had removed the television's knobs and hidden them. Although we made constant efforts, we never found the knobs and came to believe that he carried them upon his person at all times. So we listened to Musham instead. His eyes shone from slits cut deep into his face. He was hunched and dried out with random wisps of white hair down his ears and neck. From time to time, as he spoke, we glimpsed the murky scraggle of his teeth. Still, such was his conviction in the telling of this story that it wasn't hard at all to imagine him at 12. My great uncle, Father Papineau, wet a comb and slicked back his hair, and then his little brother's hair. He thrust choir boy vestments at him in a candelabra. The church was a large cabin just across the yard, and people were gathering there already. Wagons had been pulling up for the last hour or so. The constant movements of the birds was making the horses skittish, and many wore blinders or were further calmed by bouquets of chamomile, which were tied into their harnesses. As our musham walked across the yard, he saw that the roof of the church was covered with birds. Father Papineau gave the blessing. The faithful congregants spread out on either side. They made their way slowly down the hill toward the first of the fields that they hoped to clear. The sun was dull that day, and the air was oppressively still so that pungent clouds of sage smoke hung all around the metal basket on its chain as it swung to each direction. The doves were packed so thickly on the ground that there was a sudden agitation among the women, who could not move forward without sweeping the birds into their skirts. The birds, in panic, tangled themselves in the cloth. The line halted suddenly, as to our musham's eyes, the women erupted in a raging dance, each twirling in her own way, stamping, beating, flapping her skirts. So vehement was their dance that the birds all around them popped into flight, frightening other birds, so that in moments the entire field and the woods around it was a storm of birds that roared and blasted down upon the people, who nonetheless stood firm with splayed missiles on their heads. The women forsook modesty, knotted their skirts up around their thighs, held out their rosaries or scapulars, and moved forward. They began to chant a Hail Mary into the wind of beating wings. Musham, who had rarely been allowed the sight of a woman's lower limbs, took advantage of his brother's struggle in keeping the censer lighted and dropped behind. In delight, watching the women's naked, round, brown legs thrash forward, he lowered his candelabra, which held no candles, but which his brother had given him to carry in order to protect his face. Instantly, he was struck on the forehead by a bird hurtled from the sky with such force that it seemed to have been flung directly by God's hand to smite and blind him before he carried his sin of appreciation any farther. At this point in the story, Mushin became so agitated that he often acted out the smiting and to our pleasure threw himself upon the floor. He mimed his collapse, then opened his eyes and lifted his head and stared into space, clearly seeing even now the vision of the Holy Spirit, which appeared to him not in the form of a white bird among the brown doves, but in the earthly body of a girl. Our family has maintained something of an historical reputation for deathless, romantic encounters.
Poet, novelist, and memoirist Louise Erdrich reading from her story, The Plague of Doves. Here now, another celebrated writer, Donald Antrim, is the author of the novels Elect Mr. Robinson for a Better World, The Hundred Brothers, and The Verificationist. His most recent book, The Afterlife, is a memoir about his relationship with his late mother. Here, Donald Antrim reads at the 2006 New Yorker Festival an excerpt from The Afterlife.
In the fall of 1988, 6 years after the close of my parents' second marriage, 4 years before the death of my uncle, Eldridge, my mother telephoned from Miami to inform me that her boyfriend, S., whom she had met in Alcoholics Anonymous, would soon be en route to New York. The reason for S.'s visit, his first since the mid-70s, when as a young man setting out to study painting and drawing, he'd fallen instead into drinking and become, according to my mother, at least intermittently itinerant, was, my mother told me, to locate and, with any luck, authenticate a certain painting. A landscape that had, back when S. was an aspiring artist living in Manhattan, captivated his imagination. Painting? Authenticate? I said. He'll have to tell you about it. It's his trip, she told me. Then she said, hang on a minute. And there was a rustling sound, my mother's opened hand closing over the telephone's mouthpiece. And I could hear her saying to S. in a stage whisper that revealed the faint nasality of her southern Appalachian accent, go ahead and tell Don what you need to tell him. He'll listen. S. spoke exceedingly slowly and quietly. I stood in the cramped and cluttered kitchen of the Upper East Side apartment that I shared in those days with my girlfriend, Kay. I pressed the phone receiver against my ear and heard S.'s soft, anxious voice, a voice made, as I think of it now, almost entirely of breath, of exhalations, saying, at the excruciating rate of about one word every 10 seconds, I am exaggerating in fact, though not in spirit. Oh. Hello. Don. What's up? I said. Not much, I suppose. Mom says you're coming to New York, I said quickly, trying to use my own words the way an English bobby uses his nightstick to hurry vagrants along. New York, he said, and I waited. Yes, he went on. We waited, and eventually, gradually, infuriatingly, in bits and pieces, a story emerged, the story of the painting. The painting, I learned, was old. It was rectangular in shape, maybe 4 feet tall and 2 feet wide. Its wooden frame was large and slightly ornate. As I understood things, the work belonged, or had once belonged, to a man who owned a brownstone in Chelsea. A boarding house, a building in which men lived in rooms. It is possible that this man had bought the painting somewhere in Europe or America, or maybe he had simply found it. Slowly, over the course of many minutes, my mother's boyfriend in Miami told me that there had been another man on the scene in the downtown boarding house. For some reason, I am under the impression that this man was related to a friend of S's. He was, I believe, one of several cousins who at one time or another had had possession of or claimed to know something about the painting. Anyway, this man remembered having seen, in an art magazine, a reproduction of the work. The cousin could not recall the name or the date of the magazine or even the content of the article. In fact, all the cousin remembered with any certainty, according to S, was the fact that the painting was important. But in what way important? This was the question that was to become, had become, S's obsession. For nearly 15 years after he left New York, my mother told me, S had wandered up and down the eastern seaboard, living in short-term lodgings, drinking and working the kinds of temporary jobs, auto body painting, sign painting, construction, and so on, that are often performed by people in his situation. At a certain point, he wound up back in Florida, where he was from, and where, after repeated attempts, in this he was like my mother, the movement from defeat to recovery was a bond between them. He had managed to get and stay sober. He had even begun, for the first time since dropping out of the School of Visual Arts in New York, to paint. I have one of S's paintings from this period hanging on my living room wall. Like all the works he made after joining AA and moving into my mother's condominium in South Miami, it is signed with his middle name, Craig. It is small, more or less the size and shape of an LP record jacket, and it is, as were many of S's works, a landscape. But it is not painted from life. Or is it? It shows in the middle distance and to the right side a steep-sided mountain, predominantly white and lavender in color, as if overgrown with flowering plants. In the upper left foreground, hanging down from a corner like decorative proscenium elements, are some delicately painted leaves that look almost prehistoric. Far off to the right, against the mountain in the blue-white lavender sky, a solitary, impossibly tall and narrow palm tree seems to be growing out of an impossibly deep and wide gorge. When I look at the painting with its strange topography, its sliver of moon in an unnatural sky, and its dizzying off-center palm tree, I feel that there is something amiss in the relative sizes and positions of the objects. The effect is of a disturbance, either in the mind of the painter or in the world of the painting. And I feel, considering this disturbance, that the scene is missing something. A Tyrannosaurus Rex, perhaps. Then I notice in a way that has more to do with feeling than observation, the symmetry inside the disturbance, and I am aware that S, deliberately and skillfully, or maybe by accident, has painted a truly alternate world, which is to say a world that is different from ours not only by virtue of the imaginary elements of which it is composed, but also in the laws of whatever nature governs the spatial relations between those elements. But what about the other painting? The one from S's days as a young artist living in New York. For S, that painting had been, during his transient years, a source of creative contemplation, and a symbol of whatever remained in him of the will to escape his circumstances and work as an artist. More to the point, and especially during the period when he was, to use an expression that is popular in AA rooms everywhere, hitting bottom, it had, I believed, served as a symbol, maybe the spiritual symbol, of his desire to live. He had thought about and pondered over that painting almost every day of his life as an alcoholic. When he was spraying paint on rusted cars, when he was hammering carpentry nails, when he was sitting at a bar in New York or Florida, he thought about the painting. S thought about the man who had first suggested the importance of the work and about the magazine article that he had heard about but never seen. And these thoughts led him to think about European and American painting traditions and about the history of art in general and, I suppose, about all the famous paintings that he had seen only in books. The memory of the important painting in its huge and heavy wooden frame, not to mention a preoccupation with the thought of one day verifying his evolving ideas about the painting's provenance, had, I realized in my conversations with both S and my mother, helped keep him alive. "What do you think it is?" I finally asked him at some point in our phone conversation that day in 1988. "Well, I think it's a Da Vinci." "What?" I said. "A Leonardo da Vinci," he said. "Put Mom on the phone, okay?" I said. "Hello, Don. What's going on, Mom? He believes the painting may be a Leonardo da Vinci, dear. I know. I heard him. He's going to spend a week in New York, and he wants to research this, and he wants to know if you'll help. Help? Which is what I did, after a fashion, when you are, as I was, and as I am, the anxious child of a volatile, childlike mother. You learn how to appear to accept as realistic and viable statements and opinions that are clearly ludicrous.
That was Donald Antrim reading an excerpt from his memoir, The Afterlife, and that's our special Thanksgiving holiday edition of On Point, writers reading from their own work at the 7th Annual New Yorker Festival. Tomorrow, we'll hear from John Stewart, Steve Martin, cartoonist Roz Chast, and more. I hope you'll join us. More information on the New Yorker Festival and guests is available at our website, onpointradio.org. Our thanks to the writers and staff of The New Yorker for their partnership in bringing you this broadcast. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Philip Martin, Hilary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, Christina Russo, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy Thanksgiving. This is On Point.